Good day. Welcome to the Guardians of the Holy Grail with Mark Amaru Pinkham. This program will explore the secrets behind the Knights Templar and other secret mysteries of the world today. Now, here's your host, Mark Amaru Pinkham.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Guardians of the Holy Grail, the program dedicated to diving deep to uncover and expose the truth behind the Knights Templar, the Holy Grail, secret societies, and many of the ancient occult and esoteric mysteries. Now, this show, the Guardians of the Holy Grail, was created by me to specifically clear up many of the popular misconceptions regarding the secret societies, the Holy Grail, mysteries, gnosis, alchemy, and what have been branded heretical movements. Now, through this show, I'm hoping to set the record straight with hard facts from authors and researchers, as well as with testimonials from current and past members of various initiatic societies and orders. Now, I myself am a Knight Templar of the International Order of Gnostic Templars, and our website is www.gnostictemplars.org. If you go to our website, you can sign our mailing list and receive our monthly e-newsletter, and you can become an associate member, and you can even download an application to become a full initiated member if you feel guided to do so. Now, today, during today's show, if you have questions for our guests, feel free to call our toll-free number, which is 888-627-6008. Now, before we get into today's show, I'd just like to mention a sacred journey, a pilgrimage that I'm leading down to Peru in October, and this will occur during the time period of October 10th to the 17th. And we're calling this journey the Mystical Journey to Machu Picchu. And we are very excited to take people down there to Peru right now. I've been leading tours down there for about 17 years or so and gone many times, and my wife had been down there, you know, at least twice as many times as I have. We believe that the Andes are currently a focal point for the revival and the spread of the goddess power and the goddess mysteries around the globe. The temples down there, legend has it that they were built by her ancient missionaries, rather, the Viracochas, the Amarus. It's said that they came from the motherlands of Lemuria and Atlantis. We're going to visit many of these incredible megalithic temples that they built, and we're going to be doing rituals there. We believe that the whole area down there was awakened in 1992. So that was kind of the beginning of their new age. And so everything is very active, very awakened, and it's the best place to go, we feel, in order to get in touch with your own inner goddess, which is your own intuition, your own love, your heart, your emotion. So we're going to travel to Cusco, the Sacred Valley, so many of the various megalithic temples down there. And all along the way, there'll be rituals, meditations, and there'll definitely be a lot of conversation about the esoteric mysteries that have taken place down there. So if you'd like to know more, please visit this website. It's www.sacredsitesjourneys.com. And the tour is filling up now, so if you want to reserve a place on the tour, please register soon. So to get to today's show, I'm very excited about, because Today we have two of my favorite guests, Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. Lynn and Clive are well-known researchers and authors who are famous for, well, stretching the boundaries of accepted truth and moving into areas that have for centuries been considered heretical and even taboo. They are the authors of the worldwide bestseller, The Templar Revelation, which was one of the first heretical books to postulate the marriage of between Jesus and Mary Magdalene. As some of you might know, Dan Brown claimed that the Templar Revelation was one of the principal influences behind his Da Vinci Code. Lynn and Clive's other books include the Turin Shroud, The Stargate Conspiracy, The Mass of Christ, and The Sion Revelation. Lynn's gone solo a few times. Her solo books include Mary Magdalene, Christianity's Hidden Goddess, and The Secret History of Lucifer. Now, their latest book is entitled The Forbidden Universe, The Occult Origins of Science and the Search for the Mind of God. This book provides evidence that the earliest scientists were members of a secret society known as Giordanisti, which had as its agenda the overthrow of the church and the establishment of a new age of hermetic supremacy. The establishment of a new one-world spirituality based on hermeticism and gnosis is actually very close to home for me, because it's been one of the goals of our Gnostic Templar order. And this is one of the reasons that I wanted to have Lynn and Clive on the show today. Now, if you'd like to know more about Lynn and Clive, please go to their website, which is www.picknett.com. Prince, you just run it together as one word, picknettprince.com. So greetings, Lynn and Clive. Welcome back to the Guardians of the Holy Grail.
Lovely to be on. Thank you.
Well, I want to say right up front, I thank you for writing another book on heresy. I think I speak for all heretics when I say thanks for keeping us happy.
You can't keep us down, can you?
We keep an awful lot of other people not very happy, then. That's the thing.
Yeah. Well, that's the polarity, isn't it?
Yep.
Well, so what inspired you to write this book and publish it now? I mean, the timing seems to be excellent, considering that there seems to be so many movements afoot right now dedicated to uniting the world's spiritual traditions and creating a one-world spirituality.
Well, I think the timing is right, and in some ways the timing's deliberate, because what really inspired us to write this book was the whole debate between, essentially between science and religion, the one that was really the debate that was sparked by people like Richard Dawkins writing The God Delusion, which seemed to have polarised things, certainly in the UK, and I think it's the same in the States. It seemed to sort of polarise everybody between this very kind of atheistic, scientific side and the kind of organised religions. So everyone has to kind of take a position on that. And we realised, like many people, that it's not as simple as that. It's not as black and white as that, that you're either an atheist scientist or a Christian fundamentalist or Muslim fundamentalist. But there's a lot of other shades in between those two, and in particular, we thought we had two things to say from our perspective. One is that the history of how science came about has been very much distorted and manipulated. It's back projected from modern day scientists, as if all the early scientists were like that. And it was also to say that actually there's an enormous amount that modern science, well, it's not so much modern science can't explain, but there's an enormous amount of evidence from modern science itself that actually backs up a more spiritual and esoteric viewpoint. So we're going to put both of those sides into the one book.
Well, I just want to add that really what Dawkins and all his mates really almost willfully, perhaps literally willfully, ignore is the fact, as Clive said, that it's not black and white, it's not science versus the organised religions. There's something else, which is actually spirituality and magic, which is not about organising religions. It's about what you feel and what you know in a magical sense, in an esoteric sense, you know, your own connection to the divine. And that has been completely overlooked by the likes of Richard Dawkins and all the crusading atheists. But we would say straight off that we are not creationists. We are not ourselves in the other camp. We are approaching this whole subject from totally from an objective point of view. Although, of course, because of our background, we are very open to the whole history of magic and heresy. But from that perspective, we are being as objective as we can.
Well, I have to say that I have to admit to have warmed up a bit to the earliest scientists now that I know that they were involved with the heresy towards the Catholic Church.
Yes, we felt like that too.
Yeah, some of them enormously heretical. You know, heretical even by our standards, some of the things that they were trying to do. You know.
Well, Giordanisti, I was familiar with that term because I'd read about it in Francis Yates' Rosicrucian Enlightenment, but she speculated that there may have been such a secret society, but I guess your research has shown that there really was. You have actual conclusive evidence of its existence.
I mean, absolutely, this society. Secret brotherhood, if you like, is there. It goes under various names. The Giordanisti was the name given to a particular network that was formed by a very important figure that's almost completely forgotten about today, a figure of the 16th century, an Italian named Giordano Bruno, and the Giordanisti really comes just from his first name, from Giordano. One of the great forgotten figures of European history, of Western history, a great thinker, a great philosopher, a great scientist, also a great magician and a great heretic, enormously influential over the origins of science, the foundation period of science. He's someone. Eventually, he was burned at the stake in Rome in 1600, but. He's one of the most important and yet most marginalized figures in history, and he's written out of history because both sides of everything that's happened since the scientific revolution, both sides don't want anything to do with him. The church and the religious side condemned and executed him as a heretic, not merely someone that had heretical views, but actually did have the ambition to overthrow the Catholic Church, or at least to radically reform it from within. So obviously they don't like him. But also on the historians of science want to downplay his importance because although he was incredibly influential over the early years of science, without him there wouldn't be people like Galileo and people like that wouldn't have done what they did. But because he was a heretic, too, totally into not just spiritual things but magical things. Basically, as an esotericist, as an occultist, they don't want to admit the influence of those kind of esoteric disciplines over the origins of science. So they don't want us to know about him either. And the effect is that he's kind of been knocked out of history, whereas he should be remembered as one of the most influential figures. Of not just of that period, but of any period. So part of the book is to rehabilitate him.
Well, he actually was. I mean, he was incredibly influential over the great kings and princes, and in Europe, which has been torn apart by the religious wars. Catholic versus the new Protestantism. Well, it wasn't new then. Bruno, an ex-monk, weren't they all? All the troublemakers. But he actually believed fervently that the answer to everything, basically, lay in the old Egyptian religion, the religion of Heliopolis. And he intended, and this doesn't sound as if he was serious, as if he was joking, actually, but he totally seriously intended to try to reform the Catholic Church by introducing some of the ancient Egyptian religion into it. Because, no doubt, he saw that Christianity did have some Egyptian roots. It was quite Egyptian. It was supposed to be quite Egyptian in its thinking. And he also, I mean, this was such a big thing. He sought to unite Europe, to unite all the Catholics under one king, and all the Protestants under, actually, Queen Elizabeth of England and Elizabeth I, and then they would do a deal with each other, so there would be peace, so that, you know, there wouldn't be any of this, the bloodshed anymore. He was an incredibly, as you can gather just from the little bit I've just said then, an incredibly formative and important character, way ahead of his time in his political thinking, let alone his magical thinking.
Well, the little I know of his upbringing was that he came from Italy. And did he start his education into Hermeticism and the Egyptian mysteries in Italy?
He began as a monk, as a Dominican monk, which is really, you know, the only way you could really get an education then, if you did come from a rich family, was to become a monk. So, you know, as a young man, as a teenager, he entered a monastery, the Dominican order. But what sort of singled him out was, for that time, was that he was absolutely, would never allow anyone to tell him what he could and couldn't interest himself in. Now, in those days when, you know, the church very much, particularly because of everything that was going on with the rise of the Protestant churches and the Reformation, where the church was trying to keep a very sort of tight control on what everybody could read and could learn about, let alone monks, that was a very dangerous thing to do. Now, he became interested in the esoteric side of things. He became interested particularly in Hermeticism and the Egyptian mysteries, as you said. As a result of that, he was pursued for heresy. He had to flee his monastery and basically go into hiding and disappear for some years around Europe because he wanted to learn about magic. He wanted to learn particularly about the Hermetic books that hadn't been that long since they'd been rediscovered in Europe. And he formed this great conviction, as Lynn was saying, that Christianity came, everything went back to Egypt and the Egyptian religion, and that over the course of centuries, first the Israelite religion had sort of corrupted, it moved away from its roots, then Christianity had come along and moved even further away from its roots. He wanted to take everything back to those roots. He wasn't actually against Christianity or anti-Christian. He just thought that it was a much bigger picture. Christianity thought it was the main thing, but really it was just one part of something much bigger. The way we put it like that, it sounds as if he was a crank who had some delusional ideas about his own importance and what he could and couldn't do. But he did manage to get the in a position of influence with some very important people like Elizabeth I in England, like the King of France, like the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And his ideas were taken very, very seriously, even by certain people within the Catholic Church, which, of course, as far as the Inquisition and people were concerned, made him even more dangerous. He actually had a good chance that he could do this, to actually bring the Egyptian mysteries and Christianity together and actually overturn the thing and establish the ancient Egyptian religion in place of Christianity. Incredibly ambitious thing to do, but he had more than a good chance of pulling it off. But, of course, he also had very powerful interests that were trying to stop him doing that. And in the end, they won, but the secret society he formed, the Geordemisti, continued.
Yes, it's interesting, although typical, of course, that when he was led out to be burnt to death, they had tied his tongue so he couldn't address the crowds. And no doubt he would have had something very interesting to say had he been able to say it.
So I'm surprised that with all the support that he had around Europe with the royalty and the powers that be, that a lot of them didn't rush to his rescue when, you know, before he was, tied to the cross and burned at the stake.
Yeah, well, it was a period that Europe was completely divided. He was taken to Rome, which was well inside the Catholic side of the lines. Europe at that point was being torn apart by wars, religious space wars anyhow. There were, even within Italy, he had supporters. They kind of had to keep themselves away from the Vatican and from Rome. But while Bruno was actually in prison in Rome, but before he was executed, there was, it's probably the reason he was executed, because they kept him in prison for a long time, which was unusual. Normally they either released you or they killed you straight away, but they kept Bruno in prison for 8 years. A few months before he died, there was actually an uprising in the south of Italy led by a guy called Tommaso Campanella, who had emerged as the kind of spiritual successor to Bruno, a person very much like Bruno, also an ex-Dominican monk that had got in trouble for heresy. He led this uprising, which was suppressed. And it was only after that that they decided to get rid of Bruno. And many people, historians have speculated that the reason they executed Bruno at that point was, one, to make a point to the rebels that they were still in charge, but also because of the risk of him being rescued and if Bruno had been taken into a place of safety, he could have ignited a huge movement. So there were moves to try and get rid of him, to get him out, but in the end he was executed. But the story then went on through Campanella, through his successor, who had great influence over Galileo, for example. And basically all the pioneer scientists, from Copernicus through to Isaac Newton, were all part of the Hermetic Brotherhood, and they drew their inspiration directly from the pages of the Hermetic treatises, the books known as the Hermetica. All the great ideas of the foundations of science came out of those books, and those books go back to Egypt.
Well, so in a sense, the name Girondinisti, is that just another name for the Hermetic Brotherhood of Europe?
Well, it's the Hermetic Brotherhood, the ones that specifically followed Giordano Bruno, the ones that, I mean, much more likely that actually knew him, that he was a direct inspiration to. But there were others, but that was just one group of them, yes.
There was the Giordanisti, for example, were certainly behind the Rosicrucians, who are a much more well-known secret society or esoteric order. There's very strong connections between Bruno himself and the people that created the Rosicrucians in Germany, which emerged 14, 15 years after his execution. Very specific tie-up between what he was doing in Italy and the people that were behind the emergence of the Rosicrucians, which is another manifestation of the Hermetic movement. It goes under lots of different names, but it keeps popping up.
I'm wondering if Bruno didn't have anything to do with the revival of the Rosicrucians early 1600s, because I know that John Dee played a major role in that, and Bruno was up there in Britain during the time of Dee. I'm wondering, was there any connection between the two?
Well, it's interesting that there's no record that they actually met, but they had people in common and they were in the same place at the same time, so they must have met, so it's just that there simply wasn't a record of it. Yeah, I mean, John Dee was heavily into the same things. He was a great hermeticist, and he was something that most people are intrigued by. He was actually Queen Elizabeth's well, he was her astrologer, but and he was her map maker, but he was also her spy master. And he actually was the first person with the code name 007, just like James Bond. So, so that's quite interesting. But he, Dee was, as you say, a very powerful magician, a magus, and a hermeticist. And there's no way on earth that if he was in the same little bit of London town as Giordano Bruno, that they wouldn't have met.
Well, the way I conceive of Europe at the time of Bruno is that it was really full of hermeticists that subscribed to a similar philosophy and of gnosis and alchemy. It just appears that, you know, Bruno was the only one that really had the nerve to speak out about it, and that was his problem. But I know he traveled all around Europe. He must have been continuously encountering people that also shared his views on things.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, he went to all the intellectual centres. You know, from Paris to London, then over to the universities in Germany, then through to Venice, which was, you know, brought him a bit too close to, you know, to Rome, and that's when he was actually, you know, tricked and arrested and taken to Rome by the Inquisition. And everywhere he was, the whole Hermetic thing at this point, and it's another thing that's been very much played down in history, but the Hermetic books, which have been lost to Europe for centuries, I mean for over 1,000 years, were rediscovered in the middle of the 15th century, so, you know, about 100 years before Bruno was born. They were rediscovered and brought to Florence by an agent working for the Medici family. And these books totally transformed Europe, you know, intellectually, philosophically, artistically, in every way. It was the discovery of those books that created the Renaissance. And this is another thing that's completely downplayed. So, you know, everything that happened with the Renaissance, which had a great influence on Leonardo da Vinci, for example, was a result of the rediscovery of these ancient books that no one had really seen in Europe for over 1,000 years. And, you know, it was the ideas in them, the magical ideas, but particularly the image of human beings, the image of mankind that these books had, which was completely different to the image that you got from the traditional Christian teachings, you know, based on original sin, and that we, you know, we're all sort of miserable creatures that depend on God's grace to survive, and maybe for an eternal life if we're really lucky. These books, which, you know, were a great flowering of the Egyptian religion, had this completely different idea of human beings, that human beings are not, in some ways, literally godlike beings, or certainly potentially gods, and that, you know, there's nothing that human beings couldn't do if they put their whole, you know, their mind and their will into it. And it was that excitement, that idea that you know, human beings are godlike beings, are important, was the thing that totally kicked off the Renaissance.
Yes, it's interesting. People use the phrase, don't they, that something captured their imagination. But in fact, what the Hermetica did was free people's imaginations and actually give people permission to think things through, to dare to experiment, to dare to think, to dare to use joined-up thinking, to think in different ways, to see themselves as a very important part of the universe, which is something that Hermeticism certainly did. It, you know, instead of being, as Clive said, you know, a this miserable little worm, as the Catholic Christianity painted, depicted, you know, that you basically had to crawl around and, you know, until you died, and then you'd probably go to hell. You know, it was just completely pessimistic and just basically didn't give anybody a chance. But this new idea swept all that, just completely swept it all away, and instead they're saying, look, you are godlike. You can become even more godlike. You can dare to think and to succeed and to triumph and to discover. And this was that absolutely encapsulated the Renaissance.
What was it? Was the broad plan of the Giordanisti to eradicate the Catholic Church or to in some way to incorporate it with more of a Gnostic background, a Gnostic emphasis?
Well, Giordano Bruno himself had two views. One view was that to introduce the ancient Egyptian religion into the Catholic Church, and if that wasn't satisfactory, then basically to introduce Catholic Christianity into the ancient Egyptian religion, you know, to have it a small part instead of the only part. So, I mean, basically, the one thing that was consistent was that he desperately wanted to introduce Christians to the ancient Egyptian religion.
And what we found particularly interesting about Bruno's ideas, Bruno wasn't anti-Christian, he wasn't anti-Jesus. He just disagreed with the religion as it had, as it had become. His particular thing was when he looked at the Catholic Church and looked at the Inquisition and looked at the way it had to impose the religion in the phrase he used was by pain and punishment. Is that if a religion has to, the only way it can keep itself going or to keep its faithful is through torturing them and imprisoning them, there's got to be something wrong with that religion. But he thought it was right in its origins, and what we found particularly interesting in the light of research that we'd done ourselves into the origins of Christianity was that Bruno believed that Jesus had come along. He was trying to bring the Judaic religion back to its Egyptian roots. That it started off as a kind of an offshoot of the Egyptian religion at the time of Moses. But it had moved further and further away from that, and he thought that Jesus had come along in order to bring Judaism back to its Egyptian roots. But then once Jesus had come along and a religion was founded based on his teaching, that religion had also forgotten what Jesus' purpose was and taken it even further away from his Egyptian roots. And of course what excited Lynn and I about this is Bruno's view of Jesus and what he was about that Bruno came up with in the 1500s fits exactly with the reconstruction that Lynn and I have done in books like Temple Revelation and Masks of Christ of what Jesus was about. This trying to bring bring the religion of the Israelites, the religion of the Jews, back to its Egyptian roots. It's quite astonishing to find out how Bruno was saying exactly what we're saying 500 years ago.
And what will be proved, I think, most interesting to your listeners, Mark, is that, of course, taking the religion back to its Egyptian roots, it essentially meant, re-establishing goddesses in people's psyches, in people's religious practices, in their thoughts and in their prayers and their meditation, bringing the sacred feminine back into Judaism, into Christianity, because it had gone from both, been removed, suppressed from both. And so, this was what it was about, and this was what Giordano Bruno recognized. He certainly had a great reverence for the sacred feminine himself. And that was one of the major things that would have happened if he'd been allowed to do it, but sadly he wasn't.
Right. So in a way it was a chapter in this long history of the battle between God, goddess, matriarchy, patriarchy.
Oh yes. Yes, that's definitely so, yes.
But do you think that Bruno was familiar with the history of Jesus going into Egypt and becoming an initiate of the Egyptian spiritual tradition?
Bruno never said anything as specific as that, because so Lynn and I were excited by the fact that this guy was saying the same thing as we were saying, but 400 years earlier. But we want to know where Bruno got this from, because, Lynn and I pieced this together. We have the benefit of modern New Testament scholarship and lots of discoveries of ancient texts like Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Gospels and and you know, we'd actually sort of build it on a lot of very kind of specific historical information, you know, archaeological discoveries and documents that just had been lost for thousands of years, centuries, for 2,000 years. And yet Bruno somehow was saying exactly the same thing. And he never said what he was basing that on. He just kind of declared this as a statement of fact, that somehow he knew this. Now, whether he was getting this from texts that were part of the brotherhood he was part of, you know, texts that we don't know about now, whether he was picking up the information on some more sort of esoteric way, we don't know. But so he never actually said anything so specific about, you know, whether he believed Jesus was physically initiated or whether he was sent as a kind of emissary of the Egyptian religion. But he certainly believed, you know, another thing that totally fits the reconstruction that Lynn and I came up with. You know, he one of the things he was burnt at the stake for, Bruno, was for teaching that Jesus was basically a magician, an Egyptian-trained magician. Now, you know, as you know, there's an enormous amount of evidence for that now, but it still, you know, stuns us that Bruno, in his day, with the historical information or the lack of historical information that was around then, could be coming to these same conclusions. And we'd love to know why he was saying it, but, you know, but he never recorded this. He just made this a statement of fact. But you can imagine going around Europe saying, you know, Jesus performed his miracles by means of magic that he learned in Egypt. Is it any wonder that the church wanted to get him?
And the thing is, he was very daring and he wouldn't shut up, basically. But, I mean, he could easily have had secret texts, something equivalent to a Gnostic gospel, you know, that he didn't, that he kept to himself or was going to reveal at some point in the future but wasn't allowed to. And after all, when you think about it, we would never know about it from the Inquisition, would we? You know, if they discovered he had one, they'd keep it very quiet indeed. So we perhaps we'll never know, sadly, where he got this information from, as Pius said, but he certainly had some red-hot source of information.
Well, I know that he traveled to, Paris, London, Venice, some of these places which were hotspots for secret societies and esoteric information. I would wonder if he didn't become an initiate of some secret society that existed in one of these cities.
He must have done, and there's a period of about 5 years between Bruno having to flee the monastery that he was in Naples, you know, when he was first charged with heresy. Basically, he had to disappear very sharply in one night. It essentially went on the run for about 5 years, and then he crops up. This is 1581, I think it is. He arrives in Paris in that year, and from then on, his life is pretty well documented about, you know, where he went and who he met. But it's that five-year period between him leaving the monastery in Naples and arriving in Paris. You know, by the time he arrived in Paris, all his ideas about the importance of the Hermetica, about the need to reform Christianity, of what Jesus was really like, of what Christianity was supposed to really be like, that was all fully formed when he appears in Paris 5 years later. And it's known, roughly he was around, he spent some time in the south of France. You know, anything that's anything to do with heresy always ends up in the south of France. So, you know, he was in Toulouse for a while. He went up into Switzerland for a while. So it's kind of known roughly where he was, but it's not known at that period who he was meeting, you know, exactly what he was doing. But the very fact is, you know, if he was in the south of France, and, you know, whenever you start talking about any heresy, sooner or later you're going to end up there when you're talking about Templars or Cathars or alchemists or anything. The fact he was spent most of his 5 years somewhere in the south of France, who knows what he could have met down there, what orders there were, what he could have been initiated into. But that's where, it's that period where it all came from.
Yes, and we do I mean, it does seem that some of the so-called heretics who lived in the area around Languedoc in the south of France, it does seem that they had at least one Gnostic gospel that was very heretical, or at least would be deemed very heretical, that celebrated the relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene. You know, the Cathars had that and believed that they were in a very passionate, special relationship. Not married, necessarily, but in a passionate relationship. So if the, you know, if there was one of these books doing the rounds in that area, there's probably more. And certainly Bruno, he seemed to have a genius for knowing about these things and for being in the right place at the right time until the very end of his life when he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, we can't do anything about that, sadly, but we can celebrate what he did and said.
Well, if there's ever a Hall of Fame of heretics, he'll be one of the first admitted into it, I think. So he'll always be a hero of us heretics. A poor guy, he just lived, 500 years before his time. But tell me, Clive, and then your book is in two sections, right? And the second section is more about modern science and its relationship to the concept of God. Can you explain what that's about?
The second part of the book, having sort of the first part redresses the history of the impact of the Hermetica over the origins of science in order to show that the version of history that we're taught of how science originated is wrong, that actually all the great pioneers of science were not just vaguely inspired by the ideas in the Hermetic text, but got specific information and specific ideas from them. And in the second part of the book, we look at what science became. There was a period really after Isaac Newton where for the first 150 years of science as we understand it today, from Copernicus to Isaac Newton, all science was hermetic science. It was a magical science. Some of it was recognizable as the science we have today, but it had the magical philosophy attached to it. And then after Isaac Newton, during the 18th century, the two halves got pulled apart. Science went one way, magic went another. Science then rewrote its history to pretend the magic had never been in there. So in the second part of the book, we look at the state of science today and say, supposing that split had never happened, would Hermetic science, if it had continued along those lines, would it be able to understand or make sense of the modern discoveries of science any more than the kind of science we have today does? And we look at those things and say, actually, yes, the Hermetic philosophy, if you apply that to many of the mysteries of today's science, does shed light on it. And it does have a greater power to explain the way the universe is than the kind of atheistic, materialistic, reductionist science that we ended up with through an accident of history, we argue. There is a huge amount of evidence emerging from physics, from quantum physics, from cosmology, that the universe is divine, and there's no other way to put that.
But can I just interject and say, but it does not. Science does not prove the God of the Bible. It does not, in any way describe a creature like Yahweh functioning. It does prove overwhelmingly that the universe has purpose. It seems to have purpose. Whether it's got meaning or not is another matter, as far as most scientists are concerned. But it seems to have been designed. Every little bit functions in relation to every other little bit. And there are other things that gel with in modern science, that gel with what you might call the Hermetic principles. I mean, in the far reaches of modern science, when it actually becomes very weird and very philosophical, there's something called an idea called the participatory universe, the idea that in physics that we are creating the universe by observing it, by the act of observing it. And that, the cosmos is specifically built for life. That also is a Hermetic idea. And the idea that the universe is not only teeming with life, but the universe itself is life. And that is, modern science is saying that now, and so do the Hermetic principles. So basically, without knowing it at all, completely coincidentally, the absolute cutting-edge modern science is actually reviving Hermetic principles and putting them out there as science. And it is rather wonderful, really. It's just annoying that they won't admit what it is.
Well, my next question was going to be if you could see the reuniting of Hermeticism with science, but you just answered that question. It's happening whether the modern scientists are aware of it or not.
Well, the thing is that, in a sense, you know, even though modern scientists wouldn't admit this, but there's no better time to have been a Hermeticist, really, than now. I mean, because you've got the evidence now, the scientific evidence, the hard facts to back up your principles. But on the other hand, we don't know we actually don't know what the original guys in Heliopolis, the priests of the ancient Egyptian religion, we don't know what they had in the way of facts. They don't know why they believed what they believed, but it does seem that there was some form of shamanic intervention, shamanic links involved. So they had reason. They actually had solid reason to believe their ideas of the universe. And now we're getting another sort of solid reason to believe the universe is this way. It's just that the two things are extremely similar.
Well, with all your research and traveling that you two do, what is your vision of what's coming starting December 21st, 2012? Do you really believe that there is going to be a golden age that's coming now?
Oh, that's a difficult question. It's a big question. We believe that, I think, there's the potential for it. The thing I have problems with, and I think Lynn would agree, is an idea that somehow, whether it's in 2012 or whenever time period, that this great change in humanity and change in the world is going to be imposed from outside. Because we think that the whole, if you fix everything around the Hermetic principles and this great vision of the potential of humankind, the whole essence of Hermeticism is that human beings can do this for themselves and must do this for themselves. So if there's a great breakthrough and a great awakening, it's something that's got to come from human beings. And the potential is there. But obviously, if you look at the state of the world, there's a lot of people around the world who are not, certainly not in this right zone at the moment. And I think the problem with it, or the issues that we have with a lot of the stuff that's talked about 2012, which is that people are sitting there passively expecting a savior, expecting all kinds of different things, but something to come in from outside and save us. Whereas the whole message of the Hermetic thing, the whole message of Bruno, is we have to do this ourselves. That's the whole point of it. And we can do it ourselves.
Yes, I was just going to say that last bit, actually. Yes, I mean, the Hermetic thing is that human beings are godlike. They are brilliant. They're wonderful. And they can be better even than that. You know, we start off being wonderful, and we can get even better. And basically, I think it would go very much against the grain of Hermeticists to think, as Clive said, of something being imposed from the outside on us. You know, we have to forge ahead and become more godlike by our own actions. We have to make our own future. And I think I would totally agree with that. I'm never very happy when people talk about golden ages, because, you know, it's like people looking back to their childhood and seeing, every day was sunny. And it certainly wasn't, especially if you were British. I don't believe in golden ages, not in this life anyway. I think we have to make our own future.
And in that future, science plays a part. It's another thing that I think, because of this split between the science in the modern sense and the hermetic magic, you know, that happened. We go into the reasons for in the book, but it was an accident of history. It didn't have to happen. It wasn't supposed to happen. Second part of the book is arguing if it hadn't have happened, we'd actually be a lot better off than we are now. But in that, science still plays a part, and I think a lot of people that are into spiritual and esoteric matters, for very good reasons, when they look at what science has done to the world, are actually quite anti-science and think that, you know, that shouldn't be part of whatever it is we're moving into in the future. And another message from the Hermetic texts, from Bruno's life, from the life of many other people, is that the scientific approach to things, to finding out about the universe, is a valid and important one, as long as it's allied with the magical understanding, the spiritual understanding as well. And if there's a great breakthrough in sort of, you know, human evolution or awareness or whatever, I think it's going to come through the two of those two twins that were separated, you know, a few hundred years ago, getting back together, and then great things will happen.
Mm.
But it needs the science and the spiritual to work together.
So would you say that's the coming together of God, Goddess, the polarity to create the way I envision the coming new era is that there has to be a coming together and a balance of the polarity. If we really are going to arrive at an era of peace, and the foundation, the underpinning of everything is this conflict between the polarity. So in all ways and shapes and forms that they manifest, there has to come this balance and a coming together. That's the way I see it.
It's a search for balance. It's the important thing. I think it's our great quest as human beings to find the balance. And of course, the balance, you know, like on scales, it sort of shivers and it's very, you know, and then it moves. And we've got desperately to try. It's like the search for the Holy Grail, indeed. It's the journey that's important.
But also, there's no denying that science in the modern science understanding is primarily a male thing. It's a male way of thinking, and you know, it's obviously dominated far too much for the last couple hundred years, much longer. But if you're looking for a balance, we need to bring the feminine and the goddess back into it, but not so that it displaces the male and the scientific. It's getting the two together. It's all about that balance.
I totally agree, 100%. So, you guys, what would you care to give us a preview of what you're working on now and what might be your next book?
Well, it's early stages, but we are pursuing the idea that human beings are hardwired, as it were, to believe in magic, and to believe in spiritual things, to worship the divine, not in any organized sense, but hardwired to have a sense of the divine, have a sense of if you like, holy awe, and a belief in magic. So we're taking that on if we can.
Excellent, excellent. Well, is there any hope that you might come up with more juicy tidbits about John the Baptist and Mary Magdalene? Is that possible?
Undoubtedly, Mark. Undoubtedly. You can trust us.
I mean, there is. We haven't had time to talk about it tonight, but there is a tie-up between the things we're talking about in the Forbidden Universe, you know, the Hermetic ideas, and John the Baptist, you know, the Johannite tradition or heresy that obviously is another big part of what we're about. The two stories are very closely connected. It's just we only have time to talk about one of them at a time, really. So yes, there's a lot more to be said.
Well, you know how to make me happy.
Good, that's a start.
Well, I guess do you all have anything else you want to say on today's show? We're about to wrap up here. We've come a long ways, as we always do. We've covered 500 years now.
Yes, well, I'd think basically that it, you know, we're having a great time, and thanks very much for having us on your show. And if you could, from time to time, mention our website again, that would be lovely. Thank you.
Okay, let me mention it one more time, which is...
It's Picnet with two T's.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. So it's www.picnet with two T's, picnetprints.com.
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
Just sear that into your memory banks, please. And thank you so much, Clive and Lynn, for being here. I know you have a busy schedule, and I'm just ecstatic that you were able to come on today.
It's been lovely. Thank you very much.
Yes, I've enjoyed it. It just always goes far too quickly.
And best of luck with you with your new book. And once again, that's called The Forbidden Universe: The Occult Origins of Science and the Search for the Mind of God. And everyone should immediately go to Amazon and order your copy. And once again, thanks again for coming on, guys.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So next time we're going to be talking about the secret island of the Templars that's off the coast of Denmark. And I have as my guest a man who's done intensive research there. I guess this secret island is covered with buildings that were built by the Templars. And for some reason, they went to this island, colonized this island, which is, you know, obviously it's a good ways away from France. Some people think it's because there is a magical energy there. It's full of vortexes. But we're going to find out exactly why it was that the Templars went there. So that will be in a couple weeks. And in the meantime, all of you continue in your pursuit of the Holy Grail. But always remember that if you really want to find it, then you go inside, because that's where it is and that's where it always has been. So, bye from Guardians of the Holy Grail. Bye for now.